There are more wealthy people today than ever before in the history of the world. The risks they are exposed to through the assets they acquire and their unique lifestyles are significant. The bigger the asset, the bigger the potential loss. The bigger the potential loss, the more complicated the mechanisms for protecting those assets becomes. This show seeks to uncover the risks that successful people face so we can provide some guidance towards minimizing, mitigating, and transferring them. From coverage, contracts, and carriers, to client experience, technology, and claims, we will cover it all. Whether you're an agent looking to hone your skills or someone with significant wealth to protect, I hope this show becomes a valuable resource you can come to rely on to help you protect yourself, your family, and your clients. Welcome to the Private Client Risk and Resilience Podcast. My name is Kurt Turnison, and I am your host of this amazing show. And in addition to being the host of this show, I am also a personal risk advisor at Erickson Insurance Advisors, and I'm the CEO of Risk Review, which is a software platform that where we build smart forms to help agents gather information from clients and prospects to help make their job easier, smoother, and more efficient. So welcome to the show, everybody. I'm really excited to have you here. I'm really excited that if you're here for the first time, welcome. If you're coming back and you've heard the show before, thank you for coming back. And I'm really excited about today's show because we have a new guest and his name is Giles Greenfield. And we met recently at, as many of you know, one of my favorite things, which is the Private Risk Management Association Summit. This is an annual event for an association that we both belong to. And this was the first time we met. Right, Giles?
That's right. In some corridor, I think, between breaks. And I was fortuitous to meet you. And we've met up in person since and have found a way of trying to work together, which is exciting.
I completely agree. And I remember the facilitator or partial facilitator, Rick Hebert from Wonder AI.
We can blame him completely, don't you think? I've got a call with him later, I think. So we're trying to help him on that side of, on his side of the business as well. But yeah, it was a pleasure to meet you. And the PRMA event was great in Chicago, and it was very interesting to be there from a UK perspective and get a sense of what's going on in the US and the private client market.
Excellent. Yep, I completely agree. And incidentally, I also, for those of you who are listening who don't know this, I also am involved in the National Chapter Initiative for the PRMA, and the New York Metro Chapter, which I run, it just had their annual event last night at Pure Insurance's headquarters, which was a very successful event. We had 87 people that showed up to the event. We had 60 people on a webinar and an amazing panel of experts talking about soft skills in a hard market. So it was a fun time. Great to see everybody, especially during this time of year. And so just going to the whole point of events that are bringing people like us together, Giles, it just makes for a fun career, fun industry, makes it interesting.
I agree. I mean, I think, you know, speaking from the UK perspective, I'm based in London, and it's a very small industry in the UK as far as the personality is concerned. You know, everyone knows everyone, and it seems, despite in the States, seems the same as well, being in that conference room with 600 odd people. It's a very friendly and welcoming industry side of the industry. And I think what I liked about the PRMA, and I know we're going to come on to talk about this, is sharing ideas. And whilst a lot of brokers are competitors and insurers are competitors, everyone actually individually gets on pretty well. And I think to have an event where everyone kind of can to discuss the issues, and I think particularly in the current market as well. And I think I know that the PRMA event in Chicago was a massive turnout. And I'm sure that's down to the immense work that's been done over the last 10 years. But I think the industry cycle at the moment is really... people are needing that resource and kind of a guiding hand from other colleagues and, you know, and people in the industry.
I completely agree. One of the things that was a repeating theme at the event last night was that this is very much like therapy. having everybody get together and talk about these issues.
Did you all leave crying or not too bad? It was all right.
Maybe afterwards, not during. During there was a lot of laughter and a lot of smiles.
Okay.
So
good.
But I didn't see everything. So maybe. and then before we get started, I also wanted to mention that you have been in talks with the Private Risk Management Association about starting a chapter in the UK, correct?
Yeah, we'd love to do that. And there's a few who are having conversations around setting that up. And I know, obviously, it started in the US and you've got a Canadian chapter as well. But I think there's a lot of, and this is the purpose of this call, really, isn't it? There's a lot of information that can be learned from the UK, from Canada, from the US. And I think becoming more of an international network, everyone will benefit from. So, yeah, we'd be delighted to be involved in getting that going in the new year.
Excellent. Yeah. And that is going to be one of our first questions on this is what are those benefits of the international relationships? Because there are many. But before we jump there, I was wondering if you could give our audience a brief overview of your career, your background, because as I know it, it's very impressive.
That's kind of you to say so, Kurt. But so I been in the industry now for 25 years. I set up my first business in the private client sector in the late 90s. And sold that in 2010, just doing private client insurance in the UK. My link to the US came after that. So I spent a couple of years working for a fine art advisory company in New York for 2 years in 2011 and 2012, the back end of the financial crisis, which was an interesting time to be there, although the art world still, as always, remained reasonably robust at the top end. But anyway, I got to know the US insurance market pretty well out there, the insurers, a lot of brokers. And then in 2012, I came back to the UK and set up another private client insurance business, which has morphed a bit. Our core business is private clients looking after the assets, as most do. So, you know, contents, homes, fine art, jewelry, all the tangible assets. But our other side of our business is also kidnap and ransom insurance that we do. And we've got quite a large book of business, and that's growing. So that was a world I didn't know much about, but it's kind of actually forms as a business half our revenue now. So that's it's an area that we're getting more expert in. It was a treat to come back to the States earlier last year to just see what's going on in the market out there, and I guess unsurprisingly the similarities.
Absolutely. And we'll touch on some of those. And I do want to point out, and because it is interesting that there is a significant portion of your business that is in the K&R. But I wanted to ask you, where is that business? Is it in the UK mostly, or is it outside of the country?
It's out of the country. So it's it tends to be in Latin America. It's private families in Latin America that we insure. So and that's half of the other half of our business, or you know, is purely UK private client business. I think we're going to touch on Brexit and the implications that had as well. So we just purely deal with the UK.
Excellent. So then, talking about the benefits of relationships, and I've had several opportunities to work with UK brokers on global clients, let's call them, where they have properties in the UK, properties in the US. And just on working on the few that I've seen, there are differences in terminology. Yep. And the benefits that I can point out in my experience were the family office that we were working with greatly appreciated that they could have one call with two brokers and handle both countries.
Sure.
And it just streamlined the entire process for them. And I remember building a proposal that included both UK and US properties and assets. And it just made the whole thing much simpler for everybody. So just the communication made everything smoother. You've had some experience too. What benefits did you see from the cross?
I think you're right. You think of the end client or the family office, and you know, if you've got a US broker and a UK broker working together, we can speak the industry language, which the end client or the family office can't. So we know on the whole what's being discussed. Now, there's a few different terminologies, as you rightly say, you know, a deductible, an excess, various things, auto, motor, whatever it may be. They're minor, but and there are certain tweaks in the different types of insurance. But I think it's The main benefit, I would say, is having a broker on the ground at either end as well. If you have a client in wherever it may be in the States, and you've got a relationship with a broker there who you can trust, and you built that relationship with, you know that they could go and see the client and represent kind of the offering that's been made by the insurance on a joint venture basis. So I think that's key. And the same in the UK as well. If there's a US client relocating to the UK, you would have someone on the ground that you can trust that would go and see them and set up appraisals or whatever it may be, or surveys and liaise with the insurers. I think the other key thing is the relationship between the broker in the US will have with the US insurers, and the broker in the UK will have with the UK insurers, because often the business is placed locally, and without those key relationships, it's difficult. So you're leveraging that, I guess, on both sides.
Absolutely. Much better to send them to a person that you trust rather than just saying, go look up a website, or
Absolutely.
just, go to, go anywhere, just go try and find something that you don't have that relationship. And, you might end up with a non-admitted market that wasn't the best place for them, or some other type of situation. So,
It's also, I think, the other auxiliary products. So, if a client moves to a certain country, they might need their fine art valuing, they might need their building appraised, they might be looking to buy a car. To have someone on the ground that can say, don't go there, that's not going to work, but speak to them, that's very useful as well.
excellent. So let's switch gears a little bit and let's get a better understanding of the UK market as a whole. And we talked briefly before the call, and you gave me a great overview of the carriers, the broker scene, all kinds of stuff. So I'd love for you to share that with everybody.
Sure. I think as a starting point is the size of the population between the UK and the US, really. I mean, we're the 20% of the size. Our population is whatever it is, 65 to 70 million, the US being 330. So we're there or thereabouts. And what struck me was, certainly a long time ago, was there were so many different insurers and MGAs in the private client space in the UK. And when I was in the States kind of 10 years ago or so, there really weren't that many carriers, which was quite interesting. At the time you had AIG, you had Chubb, I think Ace was there, and Pure, but on a population of 330 million, and whilst there's only a certain percentage of that that's deemed high net worth, it wasn't that many insurers. And I looked at the UK market and thought, we've got 20 doing this and much smaller books of business. What's happened now, as I kind of realize, is the UK has shrunk on the amount of insurers that are in this business and MGA. I think purely because, speaking candidly, they haven't made money. And the US has restructured as well, but you have had more carriers, Cincinnati, Volt, et cetera, coming into the market. So there's been a bit of a kind of a change in who's writing business. The premiums tend to be, I mean, globally, obviously they're very high at the top end, but I think in the UK they've probably historically been a bit lower, would be my gut feeling. I think we're having a bit of a correction now. You had your hard market event yesterday. We've got exactly the same thing going on, and I've been doing this for 25 years. I've never seen a market like this. We look at our book, and there are obviously, as a broker, there are great benefits to it, of course. Provide the right advice to your clients. But the insurers have to make money, and I know there are many reasons why they haven't been, and that's for the first time, I think, coming through into our market in the UK. And you're seeing a lot of MGAs particularly, and some insurers pulling out of this sector. Creates an opportunity, of course, but it's a challenging place to be as a broker.
Yeah. Well, I think it's really impactful for you to say that you have never seen this type of market before, because that was a common theme at the event last night as well. And for all of us as brokers, clients, advisors, carriers, to recognize that this is not just a us issue. This is all over the place. And none of us have dealt with it before. Just I think
And it is,
that's really helpful.
I think it's the same issues, isn't it? It's reinsurance has gone up. environmental disasters are going up, and obviously they're, more extreme in certain states, Florida and California. But in the UK, we're seeing, we never used to have named storms before. That's now happened kind of in the last 10 years, and we have more and storms coming through. The UK tends to drizzle more than anywhere else, and occasionally that turns into heavy rain, and we get flooding and flash floods. So that is now seeping into environmental changes, seeping into rate increases and, supply chain costs post-pandemic, et cetera.
It's very interesting. There are a lot of similarities, and as we're talking about this, I'm curious, what are the similarities in coverage and underwriting that you see between the UK and the US?
Quite a lot. I think that there is the one of the. I mean, we may come on to it, but probably now is a good time to talk about it. Is the liability side? If you think about your a high net worth client in the US will have home, contents, fine art, jewelry, auto, etc., and it's exactly the same in the UK with a few differences. And everything be covered worldwide, all risks, everything you expect a high net worth policy to be, because a lot of the insurers in the US are the same in the UK. The one aspect that is quite different, I think, is liability, legal liability. What the UK doesn't have is, which when I first heard about it, kind of makes complete sense in the US, but umbrella liability policies, that doesn't exist here in the UK. We're not as litigious, I guess. It may go more that way, and those costs, I'm sure, have gone into part of the reason why claims have gone up in the US and why insurers are having a tough time. We haven't seen that side quite as much in the UK. That may come in time, but we have most high net worth policies have a cap of 10 million, and touch wood, it's quite rare you see one of those that cover being tapped into. I'm sure it's different in the US.
Very different in the US. And, when you talk about highly litigious areas, we have places called judicial hellholes, which are the
Okay.
most litigious areas of the country. New York,
The official
California.
name.
There is a, I guess there is an official name. Yes. And so very litigious. We have nuclear verdicts, they're calling any verdict that is over 5 million or over 10 million. It's just an astronomical verdict for a liability situation. So that is very interesting that liability isn't an issue in the UK.
No,
And I wish it was that way here.
I mean, we may be following suit over time. And, the world is going more generic in many ways, and the UK, when Chubb came into the UK and really pushed the high net worth market here, we had an insurer called Hiscox who had been doing it for a while, but Chubb came in and made a big splash, and AIG as well. So the American powerhouses are in the UK, but I'm sure when they look at their on different sides of the pond, they look at their claims, it will be less kind of liability claims and more flood or subsidence or those types of claims that we have.
Right. Yeah. And that kind of leads us right into my next question, which is, what are some of the most concerning coverage issues or issues that brokers face in the UK? And are they similar in the US?
We don't have hurricanes, or very rarely. We don't have tornadoes. We don't have earthquakes. There was one in Lincolnshire, which is a county north of London, about 15 years ago. So we don't have that extreme, those extreme weather events. But I think that the biggest one in common would be escape of water. That seems to be a big issue, and if you look at insurers' books of where they've losing money, it's down to escape of water, and that's a common theme. And one of the other issues is, I know there are preventative ways of dealing with that, but it always seems clients, understandably, don't think it's going to happen to them. They've got insurance. It's always post-event when these things are put in place, and that's a problem. We have a few other kind of weird and wonderful things that's going on in the UK, kind of car theft here.
Before you jump to that, Giles, so when you say escape of water, so that's basically non-weather related
So it'd
water
be
damage.
maybe
So burst pipe.
second home not being looked at. A freeze comes in. It's happened here in the UK in the last week. It suddenly got very cold. A house on tip pipe bursts. It isn't seen for a week, and you've got water pouring all the way through the house. And that is a, and that's going to be an expensive claim. And that can be prevented, as we talked about, but it's It tends to be trying to educate clients to do that when they think, oh, it's another cost that's unlikely to happen. It's difficult. I'm
What's
sure
it
that's
like?
common.
What's it like dealing with that type of claim? Maybe you've seen this on, I mean, we call them like historical homes, like they're homes that are on the historical register, but they're, you know, meaningful homes. They're important. They're large. Yeah. They're antique. What's that like in the UK if you have an escape of water?
Yeah, it's very similar. So we have a listing system in the UK. It's English Heritage, and a Grade One star property would be Buckingham Palace, I guess, as an example. And then you have Grade Two star and Grade Two star, or Grade Two and then Grade Two star. And if a property is listed, depending on that grade, English Heritage can be heavily involved, and the cost can really ratchet up. And then you have an issue with underinsurance as well. So, you know, there are claims here where, you know, Grade One listed mansion house has had a flood, and English Heritage would insist that the tiles are made in the same way as they were back in 1750, nails are recrafted the same way, and the costs just become exorbitant. The other thing, which I guess you have the same problem, is alternative accommodation. So when you know, the clients lost their home, they're out of the house for you know, a year potentially, or 6 months, or maybe, you know, the high net worth clients don't want to be put in some, you know, they're used to a certain standard of living, and certainly the rental costs in the UK are rocketing as well at the moment. So that's another cost that insurers are getting.
And in the US, oftentimes with the high net worth carriers, the loss of use coverage or the alternative living coverage is unlimited. We have seen in certain states and certain areas that coverage is being pared back in certain situations. Right. What does that coverage look like in the UK?
It's not unlimited. It tends to be up to 3 years, 4 years, or 5 years. I think the max you get is 5 years. But, you know, that's an awful long time to be paying rent at whatever amount it is, you know. So there is, I mean, if you can't rebuild a house or repair a house in 5 years, there's a fundamental problem. But there is a cap on it.
And last question on escape of water, because this is an important one for me. I deal with a lot of New York based clients and Connecticut, even New Jersey, even we deal with this a lot. I talk about automatic water shutoff valves all the time.
Yep.
Do you have the same thing?
We do. And, you know, it is something that insurers are trying to push to their client base. They really are. But I don't know how you're finding it, Kurt, when you're trying to get clients to install these things. There'll be a reduction on premium or whatever it is. But, you know, oh, I need an alarm. I need this. I need that. You know, my house, this is going to happen to my house. So it's a tough one. But I'm sure if you look across the board of the high net worth market, you know, if you took out escape of water claims through burst pipes or, you know, overflowing baths or whatever it is, that would take a big chunk out of it. So, you know, I think in a hard market, I'm sure you had this conversation yesterday in the New York chapter, you know, prevention is key to try and advise clients of how to mitigate. And, but yeah, that's the other thing we have, I guess, here. Certainly in London, there are a lot of basements, and we get flash flooding occasionally. You know, it's a bit like New York. It's you know, a lot of concrete around. There's nowhere for the water to run when it rains. And often they go down into basements, and those can be big claims as well.
That's interesting. Yeah. And you're right. Yesterday, they did mention this, and Steve Pooks is the king of preparing and preventing for loss. He mentioned this as well. And so important to do that. And yes, we have, I have a difficult time sometimes with clients getting them to put it in. But if I keep saying it over and over again, sometimes they do it.
Well, you're offering best advice, aren't you? You're offering best advice, and that's our
right.
job.
But you mentioned this flood, flash floods. And can you tell us a little bit about the flood market in the UK?
Yeah, so we have a thing called Flood Re here, which is where the government provide basically insurance for a set price, and insurers can offlay it to Flood Re. And I think you have something very similar in the US. And that's been introduced over the last 10 years, I guess. The issue, certainly here, is floodplains. People, properties are still being built in floodplains. And every year, it's just, you know, there's already been a flood. I think it's in Gloucestershire this year. It's getting worse and worse. And there's no real solution to this. So the government stepped in And a lot of the insurers are ceding to flood re, so there's least cover for the client, but it can be a bit more restrictive, obviously, than it would be on a standalone house policy. So I think that's quite similar to the US.
And are the limits, like in the US, we have the National Flood Insurance Program, we have some private market options as well, but the NFIP, the limit is 250 for the dwelling, 100 for contents.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what the limits are on it, to be honest with you, but it won't be as wide as, I think it'd be wider than that, but not as, but it's not as, say, you know, if you, £10 million house or $10 million houses, you know, it's, it doesn't always, is not always adequate.
Well,
and
that goes
insurers, so the insurers also are, they are offering terms now for a lot of properties without flood cover, and that never happened before, but that's now seeping into, so that's, you know, it goes back to the environment changing, simple as that. We're seeing it actually come through now.
And this all goes to your point of underinsurance and how big a problem that is. And it's a problem in the US as well. A quick question on that. How do you determine replacement costs for, you know, the listed homes or just any home in the UK?
So it's interesting. You talk to a client and they say, I bought a home for £5 million, which is what, $6.5 million. And, you know, they're not, obviously they work out how they're going to insure that property. And obviously we advise them, you don't insure at the market price, because a property in north of England, I don't know, Scotland or somewhere, that has a market value of £6.5 million, would be very different to rebuild than a property in London. I mean, a property in London could cost £3 million. You know, the bulk of the cost is actually in the land itself. Whereas if you're in a rural part of the country, a £6.5 million rebuilding cost, purchase price could be a very, very large home. So it's all about the rebuilding costs, which I'm sure will be exactly the same as you. And clients, we try and get clients to have appraisals where the property value, the property cost is calculated. They're going up dramatically, certainly post-COVID they're going up because of, you know, as I talked about this before, restricted supply chains, cost of labor has gone up. And so they're increasing, and index linking is certainly, with inflation, has gone up quite rapidly in the last, certainly 18 months. It's dropping a bit now, but underinsurance almost by default happens because, you know, if you had a property insured 5 years ago and got it appraised 5 years ago, those same materials are going to cost a lot more now. And if index linking hasn't been put in place correctly, there's going to be an underinsurance issue there. So yeah, getting a rebuilding appraisal done where the, you know, someone comes in and calculates the rebuilding cost is the way to go.
And I wanted to go back real quick to the hard market. And you said the UK is experiencing a hard market, as is the US. But in our previous conversations, you've talked about how capacity is shrinking in the UK. And there's less options for the UK brokers. Can you talk a little bit about that and maybe intermingle, because you also have an MGA, if you want to touch on that as well.
So we run a high net worth MGA, and we've got about 120 odd brokers that we trade with in the UK who place business into us. We try and be very conservative, I guess, in the business we write, and we've always tried to do that historically to make the capacity providers money. Frustrating probably for some of our brokers, but the bottom line is we're still, you know, touch wood, making money for our insurers, and therefore we're still, you know, going forward in the right direction. But I think one of the issues, as a private business, we had never had an external debt, so we had no pressure from shareholders saying you've got to grow quickly. So we've kind of been the tortoise, not the hare, I guess is the best way of putting it. But it's difficult to get capacity. It is difficult to get capacity because, you know, you look at, I think Deutsche Bank did a report about the P&C market, and on out it's running at 120%. You know, it's insurers thinking, why do we want to write business in that class of, you know, that class of business when we can go into cyber or whatever it may be and make more money there? So it's becoming a hard place to find insurers to write. And we have a thing in the UK called the High Point Review, which is a list of the high net worth insurers and MGA in the UK. And I looked at it from, I think I showed you this, Kurt. I looked at it from 2021. And out of the 12 insurers, out of the 12 that are on that list, I think five are no longer trading through. They pulled out of the market or for other reasons. So we're seeing a shrinkage. And certainly from our MGA perspective, we're getting a lot more quotes coming in. which makes service difficult. So it's I think that the best way of looking at it is it's a pricing correction in the UK. You know, that's what's happening in our market. It's been underpriced for a long time for the level of cover that's there, and now it's coming back and it's hurting MGAs, insurers, and making it difficult for the brokers. It sounds as though it's very similar for you as well.
Yes, it is very similar in the US. And, you know, over the last 7 or so years, the carriers have changed hands. They've maybe gone out of market, but we don't have many. And so there are not a lot of markets to go to these days. We would love more. So if there are anybody listening that can bring some capacity, please do. And so in your experience with the MGA, because that's fascinating, what are the things that you won't write? Because I know in the US, there are not necessarily uninsurable risks, but certain risks that don't fit the appetite or the guidelines of a high net worth carrier. And so what kind of things do you look at?
The example that people use of, you know, turning up to an insurer and say, I've got a perfect risk. It's a professional footballer who's 25 years old with loads of jewelry. He's got a Range Rover that costs £200,000 and he lives in a thatch house. And it's just, that's uninsurable. You know, the thatch catches on fire, the Range Rover gets stolen, the jewelry, you know, you've got a young guy who's keen to show his wealth. So there are certain risks that are problematic. The one thing which we're seeing here is on the claim side is think about risks that you can't insure. There's certain cars are being stolen a lot with the new technology. Range Rovers in the streets of London are getting very difficult to insure, as are certain Ferraris as well. I'm sure there are a few other electric cars that are having problems. You just can't get insurance for them. There's an issue with watch theft as well. That's happening quite a lot in certain cities. With the prices of watches going up, you know, that's an issue. So I think provided the client has the right security and the right risk profile, the insurers are happy to write that business. But if it falls outside, underwriting is becoming more conservative and that becomes more of a challenge.
It's interesting. It's hard for me to imagine not being able to insure a Land Rover. And so what happens?
Range Rover. Range Rover.
I'm sorry. A Range
Same
Rover.
Thing. So, same thing.
Yeah. What happens if you can't get coverage as a client?
Well, there was an article in the press, funnily enough. There was an article in the press at the weekend, I think the Sunday Times, that said it was about someone who bought a £100,000 Range Rover and they just couldn't get insurance for it, so they had to sell it. You know, it's got that bad, and they are being shipped out of, I think, I don't know what happens to them. I think broken down, shipped out of the country for parts, and you know, it's a whole industry. But I think this is modern technology, and you know, hackers have worked out how to hack it, and that's an issue. I guess for Range Rover, they're delighted because more and more people are buying more Range Rovers. You know, so it's a strange place to be in. But 10 years ago, that you could easily write that type of business. But the risk profile of the client is key. And I think as long as they are aware, you know, having floating amounts of jewelry in a bank vault, for example, as opposed to wearing it the whole time, they're kind of aware of what they're doing. And also, you know, one of the big issues is social media profiles as well. You know, people being on Facebook or with their families, kind of, with, you know, as they hop on their private jet, and you know their house is empty. And there have been numerous examples here of reasonably famous people in the UK who have been targeted because they've been doing stuff online, and people know they're not in the country.
Yeah, that's a whole nother topic. There are great risks. Yeah, a lot of risk in putting out information out there. Yeah. I just saw a new tool called Pika. It's like an artificial intelligence tool, you know, because they have ChatGPT and they have Claude AI. This is one that came out like 4 days ago. And and they have image creators too. This is not an image creator where you type in, you know, create a gingerbread house with, you know, animals. This is a movie creator. So you can type in your description and it'll create a video of whatever your description is. And I saw the test, it's on Twitter.
Yeah.
And it was incredible. So, I mean, it looks like fun, but also, you know, pretty scary when you
dangerous,
think about
yeah.
You could take all this information, pictures from wherever and throw it in here and then make a video.
Yeah.
So as we finish up the conversation, I had one last question, then I wanted to ask you for some final thoughts that you'd like to share. But Brexit was a big deal a year or so ago recently.
Yep.
And I wanted to ask, what kind of impact did that have on the UK insurance market?
I think maybe I'm naive, but I think everyone's very surprised that it happened. Certainly in the insurance market, they were surprised. I found it a shock. I didn't think it was going to happen. The implications were we lost business because we had clients who we were insuring in Europe, in Germany, in France. And it was more cost effective to let that business go than it was to set up a license and set up an operation in Europe. So I think that the larger insurers and the larger brokers have dealt with it and have got licenses and have people on the ground in certain countries so they can write business there. I think for the smaller independent brokers, they probably just said, you know, it's not worth the regulation, it's not worth the hire. So how much business have we got? If it represents 10% of our income or 5% of our income, is it worth actually writing business there? So I think a lot of the international brokers and insurers they had a contingency plan. You know, a lot had presences in Europe anyway. But for the smaller broker stroke agent, I think it had an impact. Personally, we weren't too affected by it, but I'm sure there are, you know, brokers lost business, and it's, you know, it's personally, I find it a sad state of affairs that we got there. But these things happen, and who knows what the future holds.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, it's so important to make doing business easier among states, like in the US and among countries, because the world is becoming a much smaller place. In the US, the government is trying to get, or they already have, the national producer licensing, where you can get one number. And I think that's still rolling out because we still have to get individual licenses for each state. But the process is relatively simple, and it's, you know, there's a fee to do it, and you fill out an application. Sometimes you have to get your fingerprints done, but it's relatively simple. But making things easier to do business is important.
I think the UK was probably hoping it would be the 51st state of the USA after Brexit. That's what we were banking on. And we were told back of the line. That didn't work out too well. The irony was it wouldn't have been lost to us, but there we go. We'll see how it turns out. But it's been a burden for regulation across the financial services industry in the UK.
Yeah. No. Thank you for sharing that. Well, this has been an amazing conversation. I have learned a tremendous amount. I know our audience has really appreciated your knowledge, Giles. Thank you so much for being here today.
It's a pleasure, Kurt, and nice to see you. And look forward to coming to your side of the pond at some point soon, seeing you catching up soon.
Yes, as do I. If someone would like to get in touch with you, whether they're in the US or in the UK, whether it's about your MGA, whether it's about the UK chapter, what's the best way for someone to get in touch?
On my email, I guess, or mobile, so or cell. the difference isn't words. By email. So Markham, if you go to Markham Private Clients, look it up. All our details are on there.
Excellent. And I'll put the link in the show notes as well.
That's kind. That's kind, Kurt.
Excellent. Well, thank you to everyone who is listening to this episode today. I am very appreciative of your time. Thank you again to Giles. This was an amazing conversation.
Thanks, Kurt.
You're welcome. And I look forward to chatting with everybody soon. And thanks again. Have a great day, everybody. Take care.